hamster with a blunt penknife would do it quicker.
Welcome back to Hamster with a Blunt Penknife, the Doctor Who commentary podcast. It is my delight today to have, it's not a newbie to Hamster, but I've got Mr. James Lark with me today. Hello, James.
Hello.
You've done a few of these now, haven't you? But you haven't done any of these commentaries.
It's the first commentary. I've done four of the book clubs.
And?
Oh, yeah, and Strictly, how could I forget? Strictly Come Hamster on, was it 11 we did?
11, which 11, is ever yes. Climbing ever higher, my top 10 most listened episodes ever.
It's settling
around sort of 5 at the moment. But yeah, they're very popular, that one. Who knew so many people love Monster of Peloton?
Well, I didn't.
You did.
But I feel
on
like,
that episode,
I feel
you
like
did.
On that episode, I feel like I became the voice of the silent majority.
So convincing we all put it through. Astonishing. But we're not here to talk about season 11 today. We are skipping to another insanely popular season. Season 24. I've got 3 questions for you before
is
we even
go. Is that ironic when you say insanely popular? Or do you think it is insanely popular now?
No, I was dripping with sarcasm. Although, did you notice when the Blu-ray came out, there was this sort of...
a lot of love for it.
Yeah.
A lot of love for it.
I feel like the people that sort of wait in the wings that love season 24, there's about sort of 3 in 100. That finally, they could shout out, yes, because everyone is so excited when those Blu-rays come out. Even the seasons that are less popular.
Well, and that was a cracking set as well. I think probably of all the Blu-rays, that one came packed with the most exciting, just reams of extras that I don't know if anyone's even worked their way through them all yet. But
do you think there's a reason for that though? Because I think 23 did as well.
What? Just a load of footage on the cutting room floor? And
I think they pack those. Well, not only because there's only 4 stories and a lot of the other seasons are longer.
That's true, but there's a lot of stuff that it seems to me that there's a lot more material exists from around season 24 than season 26, weirdly.
I mean, I can't watch it all. I prefer it, you know, all the filming stuff that they've got.
Yeah.
You know, Kate O'Mara standing in a damp quarry looking a bit pissed off under a brolly. I like it when they cut all that down to little segments and they give you all the best of it. But I can't sit there and watch 5 hours of it.
That's a bit hardcore for me. And just waiting for something to happen. There's on the Time in the Rani one, you can actually just watch the TARDIS prop in a quarry for about half an hour.
Really?
You know, nothing happening at all.
There's 1 or 2 people on Twitter I know probably have endured that, but not too many people.
But there is something. The first thing I went to when I got that Blu-ray was Sylvester McCoy's regeneration sequence. And it's about 20 minutes of material. That's how long
I haven't watched that.
Right. Well, it is fascinating. Partly because what they're trying to do is completely wrong-headed. They're trying to zoom the camera in. And then, I mean, in their heads, they think it's going to be simple. You know, whip off the wig, scrub his eyebrows, and it'll all line up. And of course, the minute you're zoomed right in, so the minute his face moves a millimeter, it's completely out of line. And watch is 3 or 4 takes of the initial shot. And then they're like, right, hold the camera, get the wig off, scrub his eyebrows. And by the time they finish scrubbing his eyebrows, scrubbing all the Colin Baker out of him, he's just moved into a completely different position because they're doing it in the most insane way. They should have moved the camera in and you're there going, well, you're never, ever, ever going to line that up. And McCoy just lies there while people are going, well, just a bit to your, to my left. No, hang on, up a bit down. And it's just utter insanity. And there's something quite moving about watching this kind of his prostate figure. Prostrate figure.
Thank you. Sorry. I wonder where that was going.
Already going, scrubbing Colin Baker out of him, and now he's a prostate figure. His prostrate figure, surrounded by this chaos, you know, this calm, he's just being an absolute pro and just letting it happen. And there is a point where he just sort of opens his eyes a bit and says, maybe if I could see the monitor, I could help a bit. And it just sort of, in macrocosm, you've got his entire Doctor Who journey there. Like, surrounded by chaos while trying to be a kind of absolute pro in the middle of it.
He tells wonderful stories, doesn't he, about how like they do the producers run all the rehearsals and everything, and then, you know, everyone has to be absolutely perfect on the floor, hit your mark, say your lines, special effects are paramount, and Sylvester McCoy is there going, oh, maybe I could just try this, yeah, you know, yeah, couldn't we try that? He tells wonderful stories about that, so maybe that's where it started, right there, right at the start.
Well, but ultimately, I mean, then it cuts out before you see, you don't actually see who managed to solve the problem, but you can hear them trying to lug a monitor over into his line, because they've got him at a really stupid angle as well, sort of filming up his nostrils.
And what is astonishing is that somebody didn't notice that under that blonde wig, a curl of his dark hair is, yeah, visible. So when the wig vanishes, obviously the black hair stays and the whole thing is just blown. I mean, it's obvious, yep, anyway, but hey, it was a primitive time for television special effects.
It was a primitive time. It wasn't a very primitive time for knowing how to move TV cameras around. No. They're basically doing, attempting to do a really crap version of the first regeneration. And what they achieved beautifully in 66, they have somehow forgotten completely how to do in 87.
James, doing this podcast, the amount of times I've said, how is it they've got this right in whatever year it is? And they somehow forget how to do this technique,
yeah,
it, with puppets, with location work, fades, special
Dalek
effects.
Voices.
All sorts. Yeah. Well, yeah, we covered that last time. Honestly, I knew you and me were going to go into some depth. We haven't even started talking about Delta yet. We are here today to talk about Delta and the Bannermen. I've got to hit you with three questions before we even go into the first episode. So how long have you got? Question number one is, what do you think of the tail end of Classic Who, the Sylvester McCoy era? Question two is, what do you think of season 24, which is a very different beast, I think, to the rest of the Sylvester McCoy era? And three, I hope you're paying attention, what are your initial thoughts on Delta and the Bannermen before we go in?
Oh, well, they're all easy questions to answer in a way. I think that the tail end of Doctor Who is absolutely one of the pinnacles. I've just had a troubling message saying that there's 20% of battery. I thought that my phone was charging. That's exciting. You might lose my face at some point. We'll see what happens there. I think it's a pinnacle comparable to the Hinchcliffe years. I would go that far. I think it's one of the absolute high points of Doctor Who. I wonder if the only reason it was able to be quite so brilliant was because nobody in the BBC was, yeah, really paying any attention to it. I think they had a freedom that most television doesn't have. I think they were doing things that arguably television should attempt to do at 7:30 on a Wednesday. But I think it has an incredible integrity to it. I think it has just an incredible team of people working hard on it in ways that go well above and beyond the Call of Duty. And we'll talk about this with Delta and the Bannermen, but I think there are aspects of Doctor Who in this era that are just done for the love of it. And I think that for the first time in many, many years, people are having fun with it.
Mm.
With a real sense of purpose and direction. So I've got so much time for it. But also, personally, I find it hard to be objective about it because I am Sylvester McCoy is my doctor. Ironically, Sylvester McCoy is my doctor, but most of his stuff I missed because I was introduced to Sylvester McCoy through a friend at school who showed me Remnants of the Daleks, and I was a Doctor Who fan for life from that point on. But my parents were Coronation Street watchers, and we didn't have a video recorder, so there was absolutely no way of watching Doctor Who. Back in those days, there was no iPlayer. No video recorder. It didn't have. We bought a video recorder just before the first episode of Ghostlight, and then the BBC went and cancelled Doctor Who. Yeah. So I don't think I even saw all of Remembrance, actually. I think it was just episodes 2, 3, and 4. So I saw, you know, three and three quarters of Sylvester McCoy's stories, and then went into this wilderness where I think I probably watched much more John Pertwee than McCoy, you know, because the BBC went through a phase of just repeating the Sea Devils, and then we got the demons, Planet of the Daleks, for whatever reason, they were on a big Pertwee drive. And they were the ones that were out on video as well. So when I started to find people who had Doctor Who videos, they were things like Day of the Daleks. And they were quite slow to release McCoy's stuff. So season 24, coming to your second question, would have been discovered quite late on, really. They were releasing the later two seasons more, I think. Maybe, I think Time and the Rani might have been the first to come out on video. Either that or Dragonfire. Those were the first two I saw. And you can
Dragonfire
sort of see
was the first I got, and I was getting them as they were coming out.
You can see the logic. Dragonfire was a big fan favorite and was doing and looked the most like Doctor Who. It's spacey. It sort of vaguely has a more serious tone, although I'm not sure. It's still pretty camp. Time and the Rani has got, you know, special effects to die for. It looks great. Gorgeous. It's a very glossy production. So though you can sort of see why in the 90s those were the ones where they were going, we should put those out first. I think Delta might have been the last.
It was really late, Delta. Yeah, it was the time Steve Cole was in, because it had one of those sort of swirlyish covers.
Yeah,
there was definitely some swirl in the Delta cover.
And so I wonder if it was still considered the embarrassment of the season. It certainly feels as though it was the one that people didn't talk about, or it wasn't even talked about in a bad way. Like Time in the Rani, people were really dissing in the 90s.
Hated, yes.
Delta and the Band, you just didn't mention it, and it didn't look like Doctor Who. The book cover when it came out, you looked at it and you went, that doesn't quite look like a Doctor Who story. It's a bit odd. And it's called Delta and the Bannermen, which is not really a Doctor Who title. It's a play on Echo and the Bunnymen. You know, it's a weird old title. It's a weird old story. So it was definitely the last one I saw. And I guess by the time I saw it, I'd read the discontinuity guide. So I was expecting something that was fun. And I was also kind of enlightened enough not to have written off season 24, though I felt it was kind of the weakest of the three. Well, I mean, I think you'd be pretty hard pushed to argue that season 24 wasn't the weakest of McCoy's three seasons.
James, I hate to disagree with you there, but season 24 is my favourite of the three McCoy seasons.
That's not quite the same thing, though.
Back to being objective and subjective.
Yeah, you know, I'm saying objectively it's the weakest of the three seasons.
I absolutely agree with that.
It's a show with a new lease of life. It's a show going in a really exciting direction, and it hits its stride in season 25, and it has this newfound confidence which is all built on season 24, but it's not arrived yet. And I think that there are things about season 24 that don't quite gel. And it's a very uneven season. What is interesting to me looking at it now is how this perception that kind of the strongest story is Dragonfire, which was, you know, won all the polls at the time, that seems to have been maintained. I think Dragonfire still won the highest position in the chart
in the recent
of the
poll.
Season.
Yeah. Although listening to a lot of podcasts, I'm hearing that opinion sort of change a bit, that people are sort of considering that the least ambitious of the four.
The least ambitious, and I would say that the scrappiest to look at. I just think it's the one where the money has started to run out, and it looks a bit crap.
But
actually,
in terms of like plot holes and things like that, I think it's, I mean, there's some good writing.
Like a lot of the stories in the Cartmill era, it doesn't have enough time to tell the story it wants to. You know, it needs longer.
It's his biggest flaw, don't you think, as a script editor, is that he can't get it done to the time. He wants everything to be about an episode longer than it needs to be.
It's a flaw. To try and see it from Cartmill's perspective, I think what he's doing is writing for a different pace of television. I think he's writing with a comic strip sensibility. We know that. We know that that was one of his formative ideas in his conception of Doctor Who. But I think he's got an idea of what television is going to look like later on. I think he's if you look forward to kind of Buffy the Vampire Slayer or The West Wing, where, yeah, you know, they are able to deliver that amount of dialogue. And you look at the way most of it is filmed, and it's so ponderous, and it's filmed in that old-fashioned BBC way. And I can sort of feel Cartmell's frustration, where he's just like, actually, I delivered a script that should have worked on time. It was directed at the wrong pace. And I think many of these stories just feel like they've been filmed in a very old-fashioned way, when actually they need a new, you know, you need a Graham Harper to come in and direct some of these. And it would have been really interesting to see if they got directors that had slightly more dynamism and slightly more kind of drive to deliver the script that, as I think they probably looked on the page.
I think there's two occasions, though, where the pace is right for the script. And that, I think, Remembrance, on the whole, is fairly paced, especially the last episode. And I think Curse of Fenric as well, especially the last episode. That has a furious pace. I don't know if it's a lot of because it's a lot of short scenes, but it feels like 90s TV to me, Curse of Fenric, rather than late 80s.
And Remembrance certainly does, but I think Remembrance is very cleverly written. I think that actually Remembrance is written in such a pithy way. That dialogue is brilliant. I mean, the Ben Aronovich's dialogue, I think it is head and shoulders above anything around it. He just knows how to write really, really good characters and entertaining one-liners. And also,
can you pull a line out of your head right now?
Oh, unlimited rice pudding, etc., etc.
Oh, do you know which one came to me? And it's quite a long one as well. Do you doubt the non-terrestrial nature of the Daleks? I mean, examine this one. Or better yet, ask your scientific advisor. I mean, it just trips off the tongue.
I used to quote it in the playground. Now, Daleks are such boring conversationalists. You know, it's written in like a comic strip, maybe. And so that, but then Sylvester McCoy and Sophie Aldred know that. They get the pace right. I think that McCoy is often criticized for his inability to deliver dialogue. I'm not sure he's given sufficient credit for pacing dialogue well. And sure, he sometimes fumbles the odd line, and he's not great when he hasn't done his homework. But on television, I think he understands. He's a physical performer. He understands how to time the dialogue to match what's on screen. It's never dull when he's on screen. It's never slow when he's on screen. I just think there's quite a lot of guest cast that don't necessarily pick up on that pace in certain stories.
I find him, I've gotten a complete turn with McCoy. I used to find him, he used to be my least favourite performer as the Doctor. And now he's one of my favourites. And it's because, I call him a dangerous actor. You never know what you're going to get, because he throws himself so wholeheartedly into what he's doing. And it's kind of either going to go one way or the other. He's going to go over a cliff, or he's going to land it in the most amazing way possible. And either way, I'm on edge to see which way it's going to go. So for every sort of, I don't know, Morgaine, if they're dead, which, you know, is terrible, you get that sequence in Ghostlight where there are, you know, he's comforting Ace and talking about, you know, burnt toast and bus stations. And it's absolutely haunting.
So much of Ghostlight. I don't think he delivers a bad line in Ghostlight.
I could probably name one or two. But there's not many. It's the same with his big finishes, though.
He's treading this kind of this line between... I think what he does is sort of unsung, because he makes it look easier than it is, this kind of clown who suddenly gets serious. I know it's been sort of parodied, and I think he's not done himself any favours with some of his big finish performances in which he does that, but not as well. But on television, I think he makes it look effortless, but he's constantly judging pace. He's like a jazz musician.
And like you said there, it's only when, because he can be brilliant with big, you go listen to Damaged Goods, he's sublime in that. But it's when he's prepared, and you know when he's prepared.
You can tell when he's had time, when he's not been off hobnobbing with Peter Jackson, when he's actually had time to sit down with the script.
Well, I can swing this back around to season 24 via McCoy, because I have a theory that take Time of the Running out of the equation, because they didn't know they were writing for McCoy, and that's just everybody finding their feet. From Paradise Towers onwards, McCoy is kind of the darkest thing in season 24, because everything around him is so camp and outrageous, and the characters are so big. And I think McCoy just looks around him and goes, I can't top this and be a feasible character. And so he gets moments in Paradise Towers, in Delta and the Bannermen, and in Dragonfire that are kind of dark and haunting. I love him in this season.
I agree. I think he learns as he goes on. I think he's better in this than he is in Paradise Towers. I think in Paradise Towers, you can see the points where he's going, this is how I can make it work. And other points where he's slightly floundering. Yeah. Delton and the Bannerman, I think he's
got it,
worked it out. And he is blessed with writing that complements that as well. The cliffhanger to episode two, where he just storms in with righteous indignation as his only weapon. That's the mold for his Doctor from then on. And he nails it. But the writing nails it as well.
But also, like, awkwardly comforting Ray outside the laundry house. Love has never been known for its rationality, looking so mournful. I mean, he's great in this.
And again, but then plaudits to the writing and to the script editing. What Doctor, certainly in recent years, what Doctor since Pertwee at least, arguably Troughton, has been given the kind of space in a story to do that, to do character development, to do little character moments?
No one, I don't think.
Davison definitely doesn't get to do it.
Not even, I mean, maybe Tom in his first couple of years, but later on, no, because he's just so out of control that
yeah.
I think he would lose those moments anyway.
But given a scene that is entirely based on character development and not plot development, there's, you know, the dance scene is not plot. It's all scene, it's all character. What a gift for the cast. What a gift for the show as well. Suddenly it's going, no, we can do this. We can do reality as well as running down corridors.
And he brings so, you were right when you said he brings so much physicality to the role. I can't think of another Doctor that does physical comedy as well as McCoy. Yes. The bit where she starts dancing with him and he hasn't got a clue what he's doing. He's trying to twirl her around. It's so funny.
That's a wonderful moment. It's hard to tell who's leading who in that.
No, I know.
She dives into his arms and he has this look on his face like, what the hell? I'm dancing. It's so beautiful. And it's touching. I love this story for the space it has around the events, the space to allow things to breathe. And actually, the extended version on the Blu-ray, it's the only one that's worth it. On the season 24 Blu-ray, it's the only one.
Why is that?
The others just don't have that much more material. Why
this one?
Oh, why this one? Because the stuff that was cut wasn't cut because it was no good. It was just cut because it was sort of not plot. And you actually get a little bit more world building. There's also a lot of characters in this story. A lot of them get dispatched rather conveniently before the end, but certainly at the start you're establishing a really big cast, and it's got an unusually grand scale for Doctor Who of any era, really. I know we're in a holiday camp, and there's something gloriously kind of knowing about the fact that that's the scale that they know Doctor Who can do. You know, it's
Doctor Who, isn't it? They're promising us Disneyland and we get Shangri-La in Wales.
But look at all the extras. Look at the number of, look at the children in those scenes. It feels like a populated world, and I think that's a gift to the show, because it suddenly takes time to establish its reality before plunging it into kind of all kinds of chaos.
Well, I think it surrounds you with characters that you care about as well, which we haven't really done in Doctor Who for quite a few years.
No, we haven't.
And
they're good characters. They're well written. They're well rounded. And
well,
characters
funny,
from all
James,
kinds of different
funny.
Cultures. It's establishing several different worlds as well. It's very ambitious, and yet doing it in this very unassuming way.
I've recently covered season 22 and Strictly Come Hamster, and I'll tell you now, they were trying to make some characters funny in that, but they're all bleak. They're nasty characters. Most of them get killed in horrible ways, and most of them deserve it. Whereas these people are just so lovely and charming. And my in with a character is usually, do they make me laugh? How funny are they? And these are really charmingly funny characters.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Charmingly funny, well pitched, well acted. And it doesn't, of all of season 24, it's the least kind of uneven in terms of performances. It feels like they all get it somehow. I feel like the rap party is another thing that it's just a demonstration of they're all kind of relaxing into this show. Like, it feels like a production team that's happy, that knows what it's doing, and a cast that have got on board and gone, we're all on board with this. We all have, maybe Ken Dodd is the kind of exception, but obviously he was only filming for kind of one night shoot, but the others all just feel like of a piece. And I think it's it sets the tone for the 2 years that is to follow, which by all accounts, you know, all the special features are cast talking about really happy times. You look at special features from kind of season 21, 22, you know, it's just nightmare after nightmare and people falling out and people not having enough time to do stuff and just endless frustration, and a producer and a script editor who are gradually beginning to loathe each other. From this point onwards, you get the sense that Doctor Who was a healthy place to work and a happy place to work. And there's something wonderful about that absolutely comes across on the screen as well.
The thing I cribbed most from the Richard Molesworth JNT diaries is that after the cancellation, after Trial of a Time Lord and all the drama that happened that season behind the scenes, JNT's back in the office and he's working hard to make the show work. And it's on the screen. You can see it. And you're right, it's so much smoother. The tone is smoother, you know, and everything's working. Not everything's working. It's cheap television, so they can't always pull everything off. But it doesn't feel like two people pulling the show in different directions.
No, it doesn't.
It feels like Cartmell pushing the show in a direction and JNT going, yeah, all right. Well, look, I mean, we've talked a lot, but we should probably go and watch episode one. What do you reckon?
I would have said so, yeah.
I think we could probably talk about the Sylvester McCoy era for about 5 hours.
We could.
I'm assuming you want to go to bed at some point tonight.
At some point, I probably ought to, yeah. So it's a work night.
Why don't you count us in then? Give me 5 seconds.
Okay. Are you all ready? We're
ready.
Going in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Play.
Can I be utterly cliched and ask you the question I ask everybody? And that is, what is your favourite Doctor Who titles and why is it this?
It's this because, so many reasons. I guess probably like 98% nostalgia. There's something about that explosion at the start and the noise it makes still makes me come out in goose pimples.
It literally comes at you, doesn't it?
And I think objectively this is one of the better theme arrangements as well. I think it keeps the weirdness of Delia Derbyshire's sounds. It's a much stranger sound than Peter Howell's theme, and certainly more than Dominic Lynn's. But it's got a pace to it that is absolutely right for this era of the show. I think it's I'm going to talk more about Kev McCulloch, I shall warn you, because I think he is a bit of an unsung hero.
You're speaking my language, James. I love Kev. In fact, I was listening to the Time and the Rani soundtrack at work this week, so no shame.
And look at this. We've got a full-scale battle in a quarry, and it's great, except that they're fighting action men.
I was reading that this was not originally going to be filmed, all of this. It started on the spaceship, and JNT said, no, let's start with a bang. I'll get your explosions. Let's start with a bang.
He's absolutely right. And he has Roy Scammell doing an amazing fall off a cliff as well. It's like harking back to the good old days, isn't it? In more ways than one. I also understand that Jonathan Turner was furious when he saw the masks they'd bought. And I mean, this is a failure of costume design, isn't it?
Well, the mouths don't open.
The mouths don't open, but I think that's partly a rescue job. I feel like they bought something that was basically a joke shop mask, and they had on the morning itself they had to kind of work out something, and so the face makeup is the rescue job rather than the original intention.
Can I say something about the tone of this season? Because everybody says this is a very light camp season. And this has opened with, you know, the almost genocide of a race. Yeah. There's dark ideas this season.
And it plants it in the right way. You know, before taking us to a camp, look how good this looks as well.
Oh, it's great. And it's night shooting as well, isn't it? Automatically atmospheric.
There's something so iconic about, and this is the first appearance of the question mark umbrella, isn't it?
Doesn't this feel like it's the start of a Doctor Who comic strip? This bit here, a teleport out in space.
It looks like it, yeah. But it sort of has a scale. By filming at night and filming against the backdrop of something huge, they've given it a kind of comic book scale, haven't they? And it's very well lit.
And the way the TARDIS,
And here's Ken Dodd.
I won't hear a word against him.
Well, I'm not going to say a word against him. I think he's wonderful. I think it's wonderful to have him here. And I think he's very well cast. I suspect that there's a better performance in him if he'd been given a bit more direction.
Possibly. And I'm very pleased that the moment he died was cut where it was, because there is an extended version of his death scene that is a little
embarrassing. You get to see the full embarrassing glory of... But again, I don't know that he... The story that McCoy tells is that he was sort of floundering, and Chris Clough and JNT were sitting in...
And mocking him
in the OB van, sort of mocking him, going, what the hell is he doing? Well, your cast then.
I love McCoy's line there as well. He goes, you mean 10 million people have come here? This miserable place. You know?
But this is, and also we should say, what a great story for Mel, who often is not given great stuff to do or great costumes to work in. And here it feels like she's at home. And what better
Bonnie
place
Langford
for Mel?
It's Bonnie Langford in the equivalent of a musical. Of course she's at home.
And speaking of musical theatre legends, here is Stubby Kaye.
Oh, can you explain that, please? Because my musical theatre history is not great.
Well, like all of the guest stars in this piece, he's kind of outside my frame of reference, except that he's the guy who first sang Sit Down, You're Rocking the Boat. So he is an absolute Broadway legend. Like when Bonnie Langford gets excited about working with Stubby Kaye, it is basically like, you know, this is royalty in musical theatre terms. And he was in so many of those golden era musicals. And here he is just delivering a really charming performance on Doctor Who.
Now, my other half gets annoyed by these two because he thinks they're utterly superfluous to the story. And I think he's probably right. I don't care. I really enjoy spending time with them.
Yeah, you could cut this strand. That's not how we analyse television, though, is it? They're the B plot or the C plot. They are in modern drama terms. They're what would be called the C plot, the comic C plot, the one that doesn't have a massive impact on the storyline, but which is there to provide some, you know, variation.
James, I'm not sure he analyses TV at all, if I'm honest. It's interminable doing a podcast with him. Yeah. Although a lot's happened straight away. We've got the near genocide. We're on the toll port. Suddenly there's a space satellite hunted down.
This is where I think the extended version has the edge, because it just allows a little bit more breathing space. And this scene is a bit longer. And rather than going straight into that, which I love this, I love the way they cheer him when he comes out as a human. It's so funny. It's so charming.
I love
the
costume.
Bonkers.
It's mental, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's perfect. But we get more of that costume in the extended version. And actually it establishes it in a slightly more convincing way. And this whole bit, because the Tollmaster bit is a very short section of the episode, really, and it just gives it a bit longer to establish this before we go flying off to somewhere else.
I love this as well. They've won this fabulous holiday. They're off to Disneyland in the 50s, and they're going in this dreadful old bus. It's so Doctor
Who. It's perfect, isn't it? It's very Doctor Who.
Yeah. And the Doctor knows straight away, doesn't he? The reputation of this holiday tours
company. He's not going to get in that bus.
So what happens the second they take off? They smash into that piece of equipment they go.
Yeah. Oh, he's fabulous as well. I don't know what else he's done. Was it Johnny Dennis?
No, I couldn't tell you, but he's fabulous.
I think it's Johnny Dennis playing Murray, and I think he's again just a pro who's gets the tone of this straight. And that's the miracle, is that they all get the tone of this in a way that not everyone got the tone of Paradise Towers.
No. Yeah, and you know, it's awkward because of it.
Whereas this would be a much harder one to read.
Yeah. I know they didn't have tone meetings at this point, but it does feel like they have.
But this one, which is balancing genocide with a holiday camp, somehow they all read the script and went, yeah, we get it.
I mean, Don Henderson knows exactly what he's doing, doesn't he? He is the hissable villain. There's nothing redeeming about him at all.
But he's genuinely scary as well. You can totally believe in him as a genocidal maniac.
What? I don't know. Have you ever watched Red Dwarf?
Yes, he plays
He was a simulant, wasn't he?
He was a simulant. Yes.
It wasn't very
the
funny.
Seven series. No, it was when the series had gone slightly, jumped the shark. It was after one of the writers left, and I can't remember whether it was Doug Grant or Rob Naylor, or Rob Grant and Doug Naylor, isn't it? You shouldn't have two writers on a series and expect anyone to remember their first names. But one of them had left, and that whole season is a little bit weak, really.
But I don't even think there's anything knowing in his performance. And there's a lot of arched eyebrows in season 24. He knows he's just this loathsome, evil bastard. And
he's playing it for real.
Yeah, he's great.
And I think he's done things like the spiked eyebrows. That's his idea. The webbed fingers is his idea.
I mean, it's not subtle. The bit where he's chewing that bit of meat.
I'm not saying they're subtle ideas, but they're good ideas. if anyone's going to eat some raw meat in any story, it might as well be this one. You know, better this than The Two Doctors.
Yes, I quite like The Two Doctors, but yeah. Oh, do you know what? There's something about Doctor Who going out in the bright, breezy countryside I adore.
I think people don't get this. Maybe people don't go and walk to their families anymore. But when I was growing up, the fact that what would otherwise be quite a boring walk in the countryside looked a bit like an episode of Doctor Who absolute saving grace.
Well, so do you know what mine was? I had woods the back of my house.
There you go.
Mummies were chasing me about. It was the best time.
Yeah. But don't be afraid, the tree won't harm you.
Yes, indeed. Will you stop mocking season 22, please?
I like season 22.
A song in Doctor Who, come on.
It's great, it's doing music. I mean, I wish it had maybe had the guts to go a little bit further with the songs and the musical theatre, but we do get live music, and we also get a soundtrack that draws from 50s music in a way that is so perfect. In fact, when I first saw this, and as I say, this was the last McCoy story I ever watched. So we were well into the 90s by the time I watched it. What it reminded me of most at the time was Heartbeat, which was very big at the time. And of course, the gimmick of Heartbeat was it was kind of exciting stories about a policeman, but the soundtrack was all 60s classics.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, I mean, come episode two, when we're listening to Lollipop during a suspense sequence whilst the soldiers are going about, and then episode three, where you've got that crazy electric guitar going during the climax. Do you think this is McCulloch's most comfortable soundtrack? I feel like he feels very confident in this one.
I think he's better than that. I think he's very comfortable here. He's obviously, I don't think you can imagine any other Doctor Who composer from this era. Maybe from any era, doing the 50s stuff with this kind of panache, with the equipment they had at the time, certainly. And there's no other, they couldn't have got any of the others up on the stage to play with the band in the way that McCulloch does here. I think he's very confident as well when writing in a slightly more modern style. And I think there are qualities to his music that are now slightly overlooked because his sound samples have dated, and it sounds very much of its time, but his use of harmony, his use of tonality, his use of rhythm is really exciting and really daring. And there's nothing that sounds like this on television from this era.
I think his score for Time and the Rani is excellent because it's so weird. He's just he's just throws in so many weird sounds.
He jams two things together. That thing of bitonality where he goes, yeah, I'm going to write this theme, I'm going to write this theme. There's a point where he has, he's got a theme that is for the planet, and he's got a theme that's for the Doctor, and he's got a theme that's for the Tetraps, and he just bungs them all together. And that's actually a really sophisticated thing to do, whereas other composers might have kind of lost it by trying to somehow weave their way. You know, Peter Howell would have done a beautiful segue from one theme to the next, which is something he does very well. Kef just goes, no, let's have them all at the same time. And it works because it's a point of high tension.
And he's not afraid to go bananas as well with sound, which I love. Oh, here we go. So here we are at Shangri-La. The bus has crashed while we've been talking.
Look at all the... Yeah, so, I mean, again, on a really small scale, this has got an epic sensibility. Look at that shot. Look at that low-angle shot. Look at all the people in the scene. There's John Nathan Turner's dog.
Oh, Pepsi. I think Chris Clough is very, very competent on location. I do sometimes think he loses a bit in the studio. But
I agree.
Because this is all on location.
It's all on location.
It's all great.
This is better directed than Dragonfire, I think, by a country mile. And he's one. So Burton. Now, who's this actor? He was in. He was again outside my frame of Richard Davis, outside of my frame of reference, because all the stuff he was in is stuff that I didn't watch. But he was well known.
I remember him being in an episode of One Foot in the Grave, which was absolutely hilarious. But he turned up in all the comedies, in all.
He was a comedy staple, but he had a long-running role in a school comedy, I think.
He's one of those people, if you look at his IMDb, he was never at work.
Yeah, yeah. And he's so naturalistic here. He gets the tone. He's a character who takes his job very seriously. This holiday camp is the most important thing to him. I love how believable these scenes are.
And you're right. Look how many extras there are there.
They've landed just a beautiful location there as well. I mean, obviously, they've gone to a Butlins that apparently there were still people staying here.
The location has just got even more beautiful, as I just spotted Billy there as well.
Are we a fan of Billy?
Oh, I think he's quite pretty, yeah. I'm not sure he's the best actor in the world, but never mind. He's nice to look at.
He's fine, though. He does what that character needs to do.
Do you know what I think works so well with Mel is you throw into... And so many of her stories are crazy science fiction stories, and she sort of loses her way a bit, but you throw her into a natural setting... And Bonnie is perfectly at home. What's sad is, you know, when we watch episode 3, she gets about 2 lines in episode 3. She's completely sort of waiting.
It hadn't occurred to me, but yeah, there's so much going on, isn't there? Cast, and she's sort of detached from the plot by that stage. But she's got a wonderful role to play here in that she's suddenly this character, this kind of two-dimensional character that's been forced upon her makes sense, because she's someone who's always going to try and be the friend, and she's put into a room with someone who can't trust anyone, and the tension in those scenes is unbearable. You've got someone being absolutely lovely and it's just thrown back in their face, but she's not going to give up on them. I think Mel comes across really well here. I love more scenes like that.
We'll get there, but where they just both sit down on the bed once the baby's born, and it just fades into the morning, and you just know they've just sat up all night basically talking. Did you see McCoy there with that satellite? Like playing with all the parts of it. And that's what I mean about him being like such a physical
performer. He's always got something going on. He's always thought about what business can I do in this?
Yeah.
And look at how he's handling that prop. Just bless him.
It's very delicate. Take care of it, please. It's the only quab crystal this side of the nebula, you know.
My other half got me one of those umbrellas for Christmas.
Oh, Mark's got one as well.
He thought it was going to be like the sort of joke present, and he was a bit shocked when I just spent the whole of Christmas day hugging an umbrella. I was like, no, I don't need any other presents.
You were so proud.
Put those other presents back under the tree. I was delighted. I put it up, I put it down again. I haven't dared take it out in the rain yet.
I did that this morning. It was pissing down. Are the windows of that bus smashed?
I think they've actually put something on them to look smashed, because they smashed when the satellite hit them.
Drop it, don't they, later?
Yeah, they did drop it. But I think that's just clever dressing, actually. I don't think they did smash the windows.
Oh, look, here's Ray. Jesus, she's turned up and we haven't even mentioned it.
Oh, well, what do we think of Ray?
I don't know how she would have worked as a companion, but as a sort of pseudo companion in this story, I think she's superb. She's so nice.
It's a slightly ill-advised accent.
Well, yes, but that's how everyone Welsh sounds to me anyway. So,
yes, I'm not doubting its authenticity as a fake Welsh accent. I think that the accent gets in the way of her performance. I think it gives her a sing-song quality, which is not quite what she would have done if she'd been acting it without the shackles of an accent that she hasn't really been given the time to learn.
It means her comedy lines are a bit overplayed. So when later on she goes, oh, he was ionized, you know, it's all very stressed.
But I love that line for that reason.
But she's very, the point is she's really likable. You know, and we're doing something we've never, ever done before, really, in Doctor Who, is this weird relationship drama between her and Billy falling for Delta.
Yes.
And the point is, we have to like her in order to feel for her when she realises in that glorious scene when Billy looks at Delta that she's not the person he's interested in. Oh, here we go. Ken Dodd.
Yeah, so this is where I just think he's still in comedy mode, and if he'd been given just a prod in a slightly different direction, he'd have played it down a bit or done real terror, because I think he had it in him.
Because there's an intensity to Henderson here. I mean, he's got a smile on his face, but he knows he's going to kill him.
I mean, that's just badly directed, because why is he running towards the wall?
Yeah.
It's a night shoot. End of a
this
night
is where we know Gavrok is truly evil, because he's just shot Ken Dodd in the back.
That's the most evil thing you could have done in 1987.
And I want to say, just, I love this.
Well, so look at this. And look at, now you have to keep watching McCoy for his Apple business, because he's got something different to do with it. Every time you, it pans back to him, he's doing something a little bit different with the Apple.
Oh, he goes to eat it. He tickles his ear
with it.
He's
worked it all out.
Hang on, I'm going to keep an eye on this Apple.
Look at all these extras. It's a fully pop. It's such a realistic setup. It's gorgeous.
It's interesting because when you watch the behind the sofa, Bonnie says at the end of it, she goes, "It felt like more of a production than what hit the screen when they're watching it."
She does, doesn't she?
Yeah, and I don't agree with her. In Doctor Who terms, this is quite a big production.
Maybe it looks a bit small fry. I don't think Bonnie Langford watches a lot of Doctor Who.
This silent scene where Billy sits down and they're clearly interested in each other, that just would never have happened under Sayward. Never. No. We're in a new era now.
Ah, we're having our get to know you dance.
Well,
and look at this one. Look, this
like
is gorgeous.
Away.
Again, it's a convincingly populated. I mean, that's cleverly filmed because it's not that full, but it looks like a proper full on dance.
We're having a party.
And this is where it goes full heartbeat. It's the,
we haven't done this since Black Orchid, like relaxed like this.
We haven't.
And we should.
And in Black Orchid, it's... Yeah, Black Orchid is... the first episode of Black Orchid has a kind of charm.
But it's kind of polite and mannered, isn't it?
It's polite and mannered, and it's intercut with Peter Davison stuck in a wall. So... You're never allowed to kind of forget the drama and the hissing man. This is just a dance. And
look
the only
at
drama
Bonnie.
At the moment, the only drama is Ray, Billy, and Bonnie enjoying herself.
But do you know, I can believe in that. I don't really, you know, genocide and things like that, I don't have any great experience of. But heartbreak, I do. So I'm invested.
Yeah.
It's just not what I'm used to seeing in Doctor Who, and that makes it really refreshing.
And there's Kef.
Oh, yes. What were those singers called again? Do you know?
I can't remember.
They were like a band.
Kef and the Dingle Dongles or something. It's got...
Oh, Why Do Fools Fall in Love? I love this song.
Oh, and look at the way he meets her eyes.
But McCoy notices as well.
Right, so
he's so sensitive.
Freed from the accent, she doesn't have to say anything there. And that look was so beautifully judged.
And the way he goes, "Oh, Ray, do you want to dance?" Because he knows how sad she is. Colin wouldn't have done that.
Is this our first nighttime camping scene since The Stones of Blood?
Yes. And I don't think the same sort of thing's going on.
Different kind of thing.
Mm.
No one's doing their flies up in this one.
McCoy is roasting. Look, it's been dancing a while. Why don't people like this, James?
I understand why people don't like it in 1987 because
because
it's not what they want Doctor Who to be, and they're taking themselves very, very serious. Even so,
but the show's just taken itself seriously for 5 years, you know, and it got cancelled.
Yeah, this doesn't look like a show taking itself seriously. Look. I'm not going to try and psychoanalyze the Doctor Who audience of 1987. I don't know what the general audience would have made of it, but for me, this is much more palatable television for the time.
Can I ask you, would this have enticed you as much as Remembrance of the Daleks did?
Oh, yeah, I think so, because the thing that enticed me most about Remembrance of the Daleks after the Daleks was Sylvester McCoy, and this is a great Sylvester McCoy story. And this has got everything everything I would have wanted. So how old would I have been? 8 years old. This has got everything I wanted then. It's got aliens. It's got space. It's got the TARDIS. It's got the Doctor. It's got guns and laser pistols and chases. It's got everything.
Well, it's got everything I want in it. And that's relationship drama, you know, campness and crazy villains.
He's good
numbers.
As well. This is the guy from The Flying Pickets, isn't it?
That's Elvis Presley, isn't it?
That's right. After faking his own death, he ended up in Doctor Who.
I don't think the cliffhanger lands, though, do you know? I don't know if it's his delivery or the music. There's something about the cliffhanger. I think it's trying to be really quite scary, and it's not.
Would you change this music, though? It's like the Gunfighters Part 1, isn't it?
Oh, look at Mel's pyjamas.
And it's a double cliffhanger. We get Mel screaming at the same time. Oh,
yeah. The baby comes out with the puppeteer's thumb in the mouth.
Okay. Again, maybe not as scary as they
thought. Oh, I don't care. Oh, of course she screams. Of course she does. Do you think she's going to be allowed to scream in the new
series? That's pretty good, actually. Look, it's slimy. It's not clear whether it's...
I'll tell you what, James, that was auctioned off a couple of years ago, and it was in a terrible state. Someone bought it for about 12 grand.
12 grand.
Yeah. It wasn't you, was it?
I think this works. He's got a moment of self-sacrifice. I don't just kill for money. It's also something I enjoy. It's a good line. I don't know that he quite nails the delivery.
And I maybe love
what
how
what we should have had is a crash zoom into McCoy's face going, no.
Well, we're used
if it had been
that,
a year earlier, we? That's how they would have filmed it.
Do you know, some part of me would love to see Colin in this though, because he can do gentle as well.
He'd have been lovely in this, and it would have suited his doctor and his dynamic with Mel.
It's my biggest what if, you know, is what if Colin hadn't been fired, but Cartmel had still come in.
And I can see him in this season. I can't see him in 25.
No, I could see him in Paradise Hours.
Oh, absolutely. I could see him in Dragonfire. I could see him in all of them. Clearly could see him in Time in the Running.
Yeah. Do you know what I love about this cliffhanger as well? It's the way the filler's dispatched immediately, like about 3 seconds in, but not by the Doctor, by the villain of the piece.
Yes.
Well, that's him done. We know where she is now. Oh, it's glorious. Well, look, as we're out episode one, how do you think that fares as a scene setter?
I'm still puzzling over your question about what people would have made of that and why fans didn't like it at the time. I get why older fans determined to take themselves and their show seriously, who had ideas about what the show was like when it was greater, would have seen that as a bit of a piss take and not engage with it in the way that you need to. I think maybe tonally it's a bit ahead of its time, because like I say, it reminds me of mid-90s ITV program. You know, it's got sort of Midsummer Murders and Heartbeat. And instead at the time, the frame of reference would have been Heidi High, which was a bit old hat by then, and drama was all quite gritty. So maybe the general audience would have seen it as more of a sitcom than a drama as well. But I don't understand why people would look at that now and have a problem with it or not see that as, I think it's stronger than some of season 25.
Oh, absolutely. I also think as far as fandom is concerned, they'd fallen out of love with John Nathan Turner. And obviously, slowly but surely, he was bringing in sort of celebrity actors and things like this. And this story is like the quintessential John Pertwee story, John Nathan Turner story. It's crammed full of celebrity actors, isn't
it? Well, he's
it?
Cast all his musical theatre heroes. I mean, one story
appropriately
after another,
as well. But
absolutely appropriately, and they all deliver great performances. It's stuff he builds on, because then later on, of course, he absolutely nails it with Nicholas Parsons, and people were up in arms when he was cast because they thought it's just, you know, it's a showbiz, it's sale of the century, and they'd forgotten that these celebrities can also act.
You fight me on this, but I really don't think I could deliver a strong argument for every casting decision he made celebrity wise. I don't think he put a foot wrong. I think people see them as big names, and so that's an issue for some reason.
I don't have an issue with any of his stunt casting. I think you could look at Silver Nemesis and say that is self-indulgent. You know, if you're a fan determined to kind of criticize celebrity, you know, Nathan Turner going to his Broadway legends, I think, you know, the American tourist scenes could all hit the cutting room floor.
Dare throw shade on Mrs. Remington.
Listen, I'm not throwing shade on him. If you were that way inclined and wanted to say, this has got nothing to do with the plot and it's very self-indulgent and actually makes the scenes of story drag a little, you might be able to argue it.
There is a comedy subplot in every single episode of Silver Nemesis that is utterly...
Yes, that's nothing to do. That's the joy of Silver Nemesis. You've got to learn
indulgent
to love it.
Is the dictionary definition of Silver Nemesis.
But it's I think Delta great, is better than Silver Nemesis because the comedy subplots are all... in some way linked to the plot. Even the two Americans are linked to it tenuously, yes, but they're not just bystanders. They get caught up in it.
Well, I mean, I think it's on two levels. I think one, as we discussed earlier, they're likable people, so and they're in danger, so that works on that level. But if you look at it, and it is tenuous a little bit, everyone gets a role in the climax. Everyone does
Yes,
something. So
absolutely
they're
right.
all there for a reason at the end.
So as part one, I would say that crams a lot in. I'm not sure this would have worked as a four-parter, but it feels like if they'd had half-hour episodes, it wouldn't have been to the detriment of this story.
Well, I had a blissful time watching that episode one. Are you ready to jump
I
into episode
really
two?
am. I'm having a blissful time as well.
Well, let's do it.